Rukramasya Devasya. Maya Vamana Rupina. Kirto Patnyam Brihashlokas. Tasyasan Sobhagadaya. Rukramasya Devasya. Of Rukrama. Devasya, the Lord. Maya, by his internal potency. Vamana Rupinaha, having the form of a dwarf. Kirtau, in Kirti. Patnyam, his wife. Vyachloka, Riyachloka, Tasya, of him, Asan, were, Sobhaga Adayo, sons beginning with Sobhaga. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. By his own potency, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has multifarious potencies, appeared in the form of a dwarf as Arukrama, the 12th son of Aditi. In the womb of his wife, whose name was Kirti, he begot one son named Brihachloka, who had many sons headed by Sobhaga. Purport. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 4:6, Ajopi san avyayatman, bhutanam ishvaro pisan, prakritim swamadishtaya sambhavami atma mayaya. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and though I am the Lord of all sentient beings, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead incarnates, he does not need any help from the external energy, for he appears as he is by his own potency. The spiritual potency is also called Maya. It is said, Ato maya mayam vishnum pravadanti manishinam. The body accepted by the Supreme Personality of Godhead is called maya maya. This does not mean that he is formed of the external energy. This Maya refers to his internal potency. Om Agnatim Randasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshumilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Kam Kuroti Vachalam Kam Kam Kaiti Shri Hare Krishna. So, thank you. I'm a poor substitute for our regular Jananivas Thursday, but I suppose he's at Jagannath Mandir. Odana Shashti. We'll talk about that also, but we'll begin here with this verse and this purport and this beginning. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find so much treasure. And one of those treasures is the revelation of the actual history of our universe, where we are, which can only be understood by revelation. Today, we have many people and lots of money being spent to try to trace out the origins of our universe, to try to understand where we've come from, how we got here. And the evidence that is presented by our investigation with telescopes, with archaeology, with various forms of scientific endeavor, just gets us more and more confused. First we have Darwin trying to propose that, well, he saw a few birds that seemed to have different colors according to where they were, and he thought, oh, this must be, you know, some natural selection. So he inferred from this observation that, well, I guess everything simply evolves. And he built his argument. And today his argument is carried on by many, many people, although they have yet to find one example. This is getting a lot of buzz. Anyway, maybe. Of a species transforming into another species. Doesn't happen. There are variations. We have fish that are, you know, different colors. There are dogs. We have wolves that become over time dog-like. We can see that. We can see how a wolf might gradually become like a dog. They've even experimented in Russia, I believe. They figured out that, well, you can, foxes, if you properly domesticate them, they can, in just a few generations, you can have a strain of fox that is like a puppy dog. So, but they're still foxes. They haven't become fish. They haven't become birds. So, there's just simply more and more confusion. So we try to trace out our origins. We try to trace out how we got here as a human species through these methods. We'll end up just more and more confused. Of course, no one will admit they're confused. They're just, you know, figuring it out. But here the Srimad Bhagavatam gives us revelation. Of course, we could also be confused by this revelation because it doesn't fit our experience. When we hear that two men discharge their semen into a pot and put it on a shelf somewhere, I guess, or I don't know what they did with it, but later on they brought out some children from this pot, then we may feel that this is It strains our capacity to understand, because all we know is what we've learned from our personal experience and what we see our technologists and scientists doing. But the Bhagavatam reveals the ancient, the time before this age in which many, many things were possible and many things did happen. Now, here we have the beginnings, really truly beginnings of our universe. We begin the universe with Lord Brahma. But Brahma, after receiving knowledge of his duty, his service, he begins that service by manifesting the various beings, what to speak of, the elements and all the things that are needed to make this universe happen. They begin to manifest from him. And one of those that manifests are the Prajapatis. And one of those Prajapatis we've been hearing about is Daksha. So Daksha plays a significant role in our story, the story of our life here. And so to know his story, to know his strengths and weaknesses, he was Daksha, after all. What does Daksha mean? Competent. To know that he had many, many children, and to know that from his children, from his Prajapati, from his progeny, he had these daughters, especially Aditi and Diti. And to know that from these daughters, we get whole race, whole generations and generations of living entities, beings, that basically set up the whole dynamic of our universe, the Asuras and the Suras. These clans, these are the original, you know, and I'm sure in every culture they will find some stories about ancient rivalries between different dynasties or different clans or different families. So the original rivalry of this universe is the Asuras and the Suras. They are the original sides to pick. And one's going from one to... Sometimes people end up in the middle, as we know in the case of... we just heard this story. Indra's... not Brihaspati, but... Vishwarup. So Vishwarup had both sides. And we see the result of that. So basically the Bhagavatam is laying it all out for us so that we understand, yes, we are here not by some string of accidents and the chance mutations and the cellular soup, but we're here as the result of the manifestation of material dynamics that are played out between these varieties of living beings on a higher level and then gradually coming down to our level. And within this whole story, we find the Bhagavatam bringing us out those highlights which teach us devotional service. So it's all setting the stage. We wonder, well, why is all this detailed information here in the Srimad Bhagavatam? It's here to, number one, help us understand who we are. We all have a need. I mean, imagine You don't know your family. I'm sure some of you may know people who perhaps lost their parents at a very early age and ended up in some situation where they never knew their family. And many of these people, they go through life wondering, who's my father? Who's my mother? Who are they? They begin searching for them. There's a need, we all have a need to know where we've come from. We have questions in our life. Who are we is the first one. Who am I is our first question when we begin to consider life beyond sensual enjoyment. We begin to consider, well, who am I? And related to that is, where have I come from? Because tied up with our sense of who we are is where we come from. And when we don't understand where we come from, if we think we have this sense of identity that's tied to just impersonal material energy, then naturally our consciousness is going to be framed around that. I grew up in America, so I know more of America than culture and history and so on than other places. But in America, we have there were a lot of people living there, extraordinary number of people living there before the Europeans came and invaded. And prior to, the cultures that existed in the Americas before the invasions of Europeans had a very different way of looking at life. And even today, if you ask a member of one of these nations that still continue to exist in North America about their sense of identity and the importance of many of them are living on what are called reservations, meaning land that was somehow so useless to the Europeans, Americans, that they allowed the Native Americans to keep it. It's so useless land. But even though it's useless, they feel it's part of their identity. This land is part of their, because this is the land that their ancestors grew up in. This is the land that is tied to where they have come from. So there's this need we have to understand where we have come from. So when we begin to look at ourselves, and if we think in terms of the modern perspectives of, okay, well, I'm a European, I came from Europe, or I came from this is that family, Indian, whatever it is, we get caught up in a sense of self that is disconnected from the reality. The realities are what are described here in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And by hearing about the actual development of human society, what to speak of, and also to know that we're not alone. Another big question comes by a thinking person, etc. Are we the only inhabitants of this vast space? So to know that, yes, we're not alone, to know that we have come from this incredible history, gives this sense of identity which begins to wake us up. But we can't stop there. Some people may take this information from the Puranas and the Bhagavatam and think, now I've got, I am, who is it, a friend of mine. He grew up in South India, and he's a Brahmin. And he was describing how he was taught to greet somebody. He was taught how to greet another person. Okay? And I can't repeat this. But basically it said, I am the son of so-and-so, who is the son of so-and-so, who is from this particular area, who is the descendant of this one, who is then the descendant of Vashishta. Right? They're all, because they're Brahmins, they have to be descended from Rishis. That's the way it is. Brahmins mean you came down, you're descendant of some Rishi. So what was it? Agastya, was it Vashishta? You know, who was it? And that's your Gotra. And in this, our culture in India, it's a huge part of their sense of identity. Their Gotra. Isn't it? I mean, any of you who are born in it, you know this. It's a huge part. And for all of us, if you reflect on it, you know, your ancestors, people search out their family trees. My brother is so, I mean, one of the biggest things in his sense of his identity is that he is the son of 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 the son, I think it's about 8 times or 9 times, of Thomas Chase, a soldier in the American Revolution. I mean, this guy was, I mean, we know he fought in the American Revolution. Did he do anything? We don't have any idea. Was he a good soldier? No idea. But he fought in the American Revolution. Yeah. I am the son of the son of the son of the son of the... So these materialistic identities, they're valuable for our sense of who we are. But we have to go beyond. And we have to know that we are not the son of the son of the son of Lord Brahma, Daksha. But we are all the parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. We are parts and parcels of Sri Krishna. We are his, one don't even say children, because when you say children, then immediately you're establishing some relationship of some rasa, of child to father. But our relationship with Krishna is even more intimate, because we are his parts. We are fundamentally part of him. We are all part of him. Not that I'm a part of him, but you're somebody else. You're the son of the son of Daitya or something. No. Not that you, well, I am the son of the son of Vashishta. So I am actually, you know, every single one of us. Not just one, just us in this room. But every living being. We're all simply parts of Krishna. And as the parts of Krishna, what are we? Who are we? We are servants of Krishna. That's it. That's all we actually need to know. But to get there, the Bhagavatam helps us out. Okay, well, first of all, understand you're not just the son of the son of God, but you have this whole history. So that's, you know, you're part of all of that. But even that's not truly who you are. And gradually, the Bhagavatam reveals to us who we actually are and what we are meant to do by bringing us to Goloka. We go through these different cantos. Now we're going through, we're hearing about Krishna's appearance. First to get some faith. Who is Krishna? To get some faith that Krishna is not one of these who just appears like Vashishta or all the people that we've just heard about. This particular verse, and I better stop soon because I want to say something about Udana Shashti, but this particular verse is introducing Urukrama. And though not going to go much further. Next chapter we get more. But Prabhupada is bringing out that when Krishna appears, although he appears in all of this dynasties, he appears as the son of the, you know, this and the, he appears, but he is not the manifestation of material, some material arrangement. He appears by his own potency. Now we appear in this world forced by our karma. Our karma brings us into this body or that body. But Krishna is not forced by anything. He appears in these dynasties, in these families, but he appears from his own energy. So today is Odhana Shashti, and I asked about 7 different people before class today who I thought, first I asked somebody, well, what is the meaning of the word Odhana? So if anyone gets it, they'll get a real prize. I asked Sankarshan Nitai, he says, what is the meaning of Odhana? And he called somebody else, hey, Panditji, what is the meaning of Odhana? So, what's the meaning of it? Finally somebody said, well, I will find out and I'll let you know. So I still don't know what the meaning of the word Odhana is. Does anybody, you know what the meaning of the word Odhana is? We know that what the day means, but does Odhana, the word itself? Cover over. Okay, see? We have the pandit is here. Okay. So, but this day is Odhana Shashti, meaning that today, being literally, and I think we're all feeling it, that the winter is really coming strong on us, right? Gotten a little colder. So today, Jagannath is offered new cloth. But particularly, he's offered starched cloth. Get a little more bulk in it, I guess, you know, a little more weight. So he's offered fresh, new, starched cloth. And this is pastime that Jagannath has been relishing for forever. So the story goes that Pundarik Vidyanidhi, and anyone can correct me because this is fresh in my memory, having just read it, and I may be wrong at some. Pundarik Vidyanidhi was in Puri on this day and talking to Gadadhar. And he was, because normally there's a rule in the worship of Lord Jagannath that before offering any cloth to Lord Jagannath, it should be washed. The starch is not put in by the pujaris. The starch in the cloth is from the weavers. The weavers weave the cloth and then they starch it up and then they fold it. And I'm sure all of you who have bought clothing in India, what's the first thing you do after you buy the clothing generally? You wash it because it's kind of stiff and, you know, it's not so comfortable. But in any case, and it's also from the point of view of Jagannath or the deity, the principle is that, well, this has been, you know, handled so many times, it's been handled by people, the weaver may not even known that it's being offered to the Lord. So you wash it, you clean it, you make sure it's all very nice, then you prepare it and then you offer it. But for some reason, and I don't think, is there any explanation, Pankajanri, of why Jagannath likes to wear this starch cloth? But somehow or other, he likes it. So this conversation is going on. Pundarik is questioning. He said, well, what is it? And then Gadadhar said, but the Lord likes it. So we offer it to him. And Pundarik is satisfied. Yes, okay, the Lord likes it. But then he starts to wonder, but what about all these, the pujaris, the pandas? They're also wearing this starch cloth. I mean, what's their business? This is not right. And he begins to question like this. And Gadadhar, they're having this conversation, and Gadadhar is saying, well, but, you know, they're the Pracharis. This is the way it is. This has been going on like this. It's the tradition. And Pundarika is, oh, all right. I mean, but in his mind, there's some question about this. And then something extraordinary. Something extraordinary. He retires for the night, and there he is, and in his dream, who comes?
Jagannath.
And Balaram. Jagannath and Balaram come. And what do we know about Jagannath and Balaram? Do they have, what do they, don't really have hands, but this time, they've got hands. And they slap Pundarika. Who are you? Who are you to question our servants, to doubt they're doing this for us? Who are you to question? Pundarika wakes up in bliss. I've been chastised by the Supreme Lord. This is the difference between a devotee and the non-devotees. They take the mercy of Krishna in whatever form it comes. Maybe it comes as a loving embrace, and sometimes it comes Ashlishyava Bharatam Vanastuma Adarshanam Marma Tam Kuru Tuva Yata Tata Vitata Dulumputo Jatpranas Tu Seva Napuro. Sometimes it comes in a painful way. Doesn't matter. To the pure devotee, it's all the ecstasy of having this relationship with Krishna. Krishna, who is beyond our ability to rationalize and just understand, well, but why are you wearing starch cloth? I mean, Krishna does what he wants to do. And we have the opportunity to hear of his pastimes, to relish those pastimes. Sometimes perhaps to understand them, often not to understand them, but to relish them because they're suffused, as in this, with love. Why did Jagannath want to teach Pundarika a lesson? He wanted to teach him a lesson of love. That it's not in the externals. It's in the mood, it's in the attitude. The Sevites of Lord Jagannath, they carried on their activity for service, not for any other purpose. And Pundarika got the message. So, sorry to take a little bit of time, but thank you very much. I guess we're over time, but if anyone has a question, that because I may have said something, I'm sure probably I did say something that could have been wrong or confusing or whatever, then I'm willing to spend a little time, or if you have a couple, maybe Pankajanri, you have something more to say on Udana Shashti? I covered the basis. Thank you very much. But everyone is welcome to go if you need to, but if you have a question, I'll stay for a few minutes. Yes, Nidra.
We have our family history that makes us foreigners here in the land of Bengal, and a lot of the local people treat us that way, you know, like, because you don't have the ancestry that we have, weren't born in India, you're just foreigners here, and then they seem to resent us, like, to some extent, one extent to another. And then we also feel like, you know, we miss being with our own kind, you know. It's like we feel like we're strangers in a strange land sometimes.
Consider what Srila Prabhupada felt like when he went to America. Consider that. Our godbrother Yogeshwar is coming out with his book. It's titled Swami in a Strange Land. So go ahead. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Well, you're getting to... You're answering my question, actually, but just, you know, how is our value as foreigners? What is, you know, what can we be enthused about by being so far away from our
We can be enthused by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's desire. He said, when will that day come? When the Americans and the Europeans will join with their Bengali brothers and chant Sri Nam, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So we can be enthused that we are helping to please, and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's desire, and of course all the Acharyas. They wanted one world to be united. Prabhupada spoke a lot about this. Although there is you know, contemporary society, there are a lot of people out there who will who raise the specter of one world government, and it will be like you know, Big Brother, and they have conspiracy theories, and the Illuminati, it goes on and on and on. But Srila Prabhupada, he often spoke of one world, one united world, where we would rise above our false identity as being from this country, or this heritage or that heritage. Not that it's meaningless or that it's totally, you know, we can incorporate these things into our unique personas, because we cultivate, that's what we do in the material world, we cultivate a persona. So let's cultivate personas that have some substance, but let's make sure that those personas are dedicated to the service of Krishna. And that variety, you have a persona of pizza, you know, a pizza, the pizza persona, you know, yeah, you then do it well and make good pizza. And you have a Bengali persona, and you can really take all those, you can take a leaf from any plant and turn it into a sabji, and it's delicious. Fantastic. So, you know, there are little, you know, elements of these things that we can use for Krishna service, but not with attachment, and not definitely not with an eye to discriminating and becoming, you know, proud.
Say that again.
Not to the point of becoming proud of our specific heritage and our, but realizing that it's all, you know, it's just the varieties of this world. And it's all useless unless it's offered in Krishna's service. But if it's offered in Krishna's service, then the unique cultural, you know, aspects that each one... Prabhupada liked to, you know, he used to... Right, you Americans, you like to do big things. You like to, you know, then do something big for Krishna. So whatever we have, maybe from our family backgrounds or cultural, or that, if we can use them for Krishna service, all good. But if we become proud of it, and we begin to discriminate that ours is better than someone else's, And then we're in Maya. We're in illusion, because it isn't. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes.
Hare Krishna. This little boy who was here had to leave, but he asked me to ask a question.
Oh, but he's not here, so then how will you know
but
the answer?
But he might be listening in the radio. He's taking breakfast. So he asked where, because we were talking where are we coming from, so he wants to know where are the dinosaurs coming from.
The what?
Dinosaurs.
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 Good question. When he finds out the answer, then I'll be interested to know myself. We know that they're coming from Krishna. We know that they're coming from some Prajapati. I mean, they make all kinds of things. You know, they take the Prajapatis to give birth to not just, you know, human-like, you know, demigods and demons and so on, but you'll see. There's been earlier, it was talking about the fire came out, and the snakes, and the wind, and the maruts are just being described here. The maruts, airs. So, for some reason, for some particular period of time in the universe, there was a need for these creatures to roam around, and that's all we know. They were there. I mean, the evidence is there that they did exist. I don't think there's any question that there were some, unless the Maya is really trying to do something for us and has created false evidence. But otherwise, their remains are all over the place. So they must have been there. What they were doing, why they were doing it, when they were doing it. Science is going to tell you, but then this day they tell you today this is what they were doing and so on. Next year they'll tell you, well, actually we found that there was a mistake in the way that we calculated and now it's something else. But one thing that is that some devotees are trying to demonstrate, which is very interesting, is that while these dinosaurs and so on were roaming around, there were human beings like us. Which makes everything very curious. So, maybe they were, my son has a book called Dinotopia. I don't know if any of you have seen this. So in this book, the human beings and the dinosaurs are living together. And the dinosaurs are basically helping the human beings in carrying big loads and doing other things that the humans couldn't do. So who knows? It's not really very relevant. But they're not here anymore. Some of them. There's apparently some remnants in the oceans. There's a Timingila fish. Apparently he's still around. Some people have seen. And we still have crocodiles and alligators who are similar. So. But I think one thing we can take the scientists... It seems logical that they didn't have very big brains.
The dinosaurs.
But the ones that do, I mean, there are some, this is for all of us to think about. There are other creatures that are living with us today, elephants, for example, who have quite interesting things going on up there. Dolphins, who are they've got a lot of interesting stuff. And we think we're the great, species. Of course, we have one special thing, is we have Krishna's, the opportunity to serve Krishna in a very special, deep way. But if we don't do that, then we're no better than the dinosaurs. So, yes, Jayashi.
Oh, without getting too philosophical, but prajaksha means direct perception. Yeah. So archaeologists find something, an impression in some rock or a bone or something. From that they go to, I think it's called anuma. Next level is to extrapolate from the direct perception. So then the mental gymnastics go, and we see this shape of being, and they add on a head here, and they figure out they found another bone, so they'll put some wings. These ones must have flown. There's massive, massive amounts of mental speculation. So I think it's we have to be very careful as parents, because I see many children, dinosaurs are, it's all true, and it was all... Something may have been.
If you ever go to, I mean, I have lived in America, where there's a few dinosaur parks, and you go and you see, you know, right there in the ground. It's not taken out, it's right there. And you get to see the entire skeleton of a brontosaurus. I mean, it's right in what they call a brontosaurus, right? This huge creature, something that certainly does not roam around the planet today. Now, did it have scaly skin? Did it have this color? It's all speculation. But its size, it's, you know, these are, you can infer these things. But these creatures were there. Somehow. Unless there's some, Maya may have done some interesting thing that, and this is what Christians think. They think that the world was, everything was created 6,000 years ago or something, with dinosaur bones inside of it. You know, the world was created with all the stuff, dinosaur bones and this and that and fossils. It was all the evidence that we now think is evidence of the development of this, or scientists think is the evidence of the development of the Earth, that all of this was created at one time with all of the evidence there simply to confuse us, I guess. So that's a possibility. Although that's not what Bhagavatam says. Bhagavatam says that this planet has been around for millions and millions of years, and it's been submerged in water, it's been taken up, it's gone through a lot of stuff which could easily explain for the things that we see. So there are ways to explain what we see through the eyes of the Bhagavatam, rather than simply, you know, denying that they exist. They do exist. We see them. But how do we explain them? Do we explain them simply through science, or do we try to explain through the eyes of Srimad Bhagavatam? And those who are really scientific will take the Bhagavatam, which has clues. My friend Vrasaraj is building a big career on taking the... I shouldn't say he's building a career. He's doing a service. I shouldn't, because it has nothing to do with his career. He's doing a real fundamental service by focusing on the Sankhya descriptions in the third canto and relating them to quantum physics and explaining things, reaching an explanation of things that the top scientists of the world have been struggling to explain for ever since Einstein. And he is working on explanations, solutions that are based on the Srimad Bhagavatam that actually explain fundamental physics. Now that is... that opens up so much. So similarly, we don't, you know, dinosaurs are not very important. You know, who cares? But if we can explain the laws of physics using the Bhagavatam. So here we are also building the Vedic planetarium to get people to appreciate that the Bhagavatam offers a different way of looking at the universe. Thank you for Hare Krishna.